I'm here to tell you that, I like Story County's money, but I will also tell you that, you are leaving state money on the table every day that you go without a local housing trust fund.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, places, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Unfortunately, this season of joy and giving has been marred by the news of more mass shootings and feelings of fear, anger, and despair that arise from them. Later in the show, we will hear from Keith Morgan and a guest from the Story County Sheriff's Department to talk about how they have been coordinating efforts countywide to keep the public safe in the very small but real chance that violence should come to our community. This may be a disturbing conversation for some to hear, so please be forewarned. On a more optimistic note, we start the show with a report of a local advocacy group that has been working for about 5 years and is beginning to see results. The Amos Affordable Housing Advocacy Group in Ames has become very active promoting a vision of Ames being a place where those who work here can afford to live here. And this group has not just promoted this vision, but concrete means for making it happen. We have a couple of folks who have been members of the group since its inception: retired sociology professor Jan Flora and emergency residence project director Vic Moss. And we have someone who has been on the receiving end, so to speak, of such advocacy efforts, City Council member Amber Corrieri. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So recently, the Amos Affordable Housing Group put on a lunch and learn event featuring a guest from Des Moines talking about the issue of local housing trusts. And all of you were there, along with many others, and I hope to make that the focus of most of our conversation. But first, let's help the radio audience understand what Amos is. Amos is short for a Mid-Iowa Organizing Strategy, and it is the parent of this group on affordable housing here in Ames. Jan Flora, can you give us a brief summary of Amos, its goals and approaches, and how this special group on affordable housing was formed?
Amos is an organization of organizations. We have 8 churches and 2 other organizations that are members of Amos, including the Emergency Residence Project and the Story County Community Housing Corporation. Perspective is that we believe that change is relational, and I think our effort in the housing area certainly illustrates that. And secondly, we believe in the iron rule, which says don't do anything for others that they can do for themselves. And the third element is the question of organized money versus organized people. And we're very much on the side of organized people because we don't have as much money as you might need just to use money to bring about social change. We've been working a couple of years on affordable housing, and the initial effort was with respect to the Community Development Block Grant and making sure that rather than paying for curbs and gutters, that it focused more specifically on direct assistance to low-income persons to improve their housing situation. And we received really good cooperation from the city on that. But we recognized that that was not enough, that the Community Development Block Grant, even though it's now less than $500,000, which sounds like a lot of money, but it's not very much when you think about the housing deficits, particularly for low-income people. So we've begun working on a conference, which I think we'll talk a little bit more about. We brought together different civic groups that had interests in housing, and we've been working on it on developing the program for about a year, and it'll be sponsored by the City of Ames, by Iowa State University, and we hope by the Story County Board of Supervisors, whom we'll meet with tomorrow to get their answer.
Okay. So that really illustrates, it sounds like, the relational aspect that you spoke of first, that it, rather than confront, you join with and advise, encourage, and so forth. And Amber Corrieri, as a city council candidate a few years ago, you encountered the Amos Affordable Housing Team. Can you describe what that first encounter with this advocacy group was like?
Sure. That wasn't certainly my first introduction to Amos. I had been familiar with Amos for several years prior to that from my work on the Human Relations Commission and the Mayor's Inclusive Community Task Force. So I had been aware of many of the efforts that Amos had been working on in the community and, of course, throughout the state as well. When I was running for council and met with the Affordable Housing Group and we really started talking about the Community Development Block Grant Funds, or CDBG, I began to, like Jan said, realize that we needed to go far beyond those CDBG funds if we were going to really nail down the issues related to affordable housing and make some headway. And I was familiar with housing trusts just simply due to my role at Mainstream Living and because we are the recipient of funds from the Polk County Housing Trust for one of our projects. Mainstream Living is a nonprofit based here in Ames that provides services to people with disabilities and mental illness. We also serve Polk County fairly extensively in our mental health program. And we have a program called Unity Place in Polk County that serves homeless women. And that is the program specifically that's funded by the Polk County Housing Trust and has been for several years. So I raised the idea of a housing trust and talked about it pretty extensively throughout the campaign process and have continued to be involved with the conference and the group as we talk about affordable housing issues so that hopefully we can bring additional community members and stakeholders into that conversation and move that process forward.
Okay, so this was a case in which the advocacy group, rather than pushing an idea on the candidate, was actually receiving a good idea, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And Amber's been a really strong supporter from the very beginning.
And Vic, a word from you before we go in and talk about the talk that we all heard last month from Eric Burmeister. You've been at your job at the Emergency Residence Project, the homeless shelter that serves Story County, for going on 30 years now. And I know at this time of year you're especially busy, so I thank you for coming in. Why have you chosen to be involved in the Amos Affordable Housing Group? I'm sure you have a lot of other meetings to go to.
Well, I sometimes think that we have talked this issue to death. You know, we've had meetings after meeting with different groups I'm part of, but I never came across a group that had it seemed to understand exactly what it took to affect social change. And it's not just enough to talk about a problem. You really have to know where to spend your time and how to organize. And so that's why I'm really drawn to Amos, is that they have a track record in which they pick issues that are doable, and then they focus on those.
So about a month ago, the Amos group hosted a lunchtime presentation in Ames Council Chambers by Eric Burmeister, who's the executive director of the Polk County Housing Trust. This presentation was well attended, except I should say by the media. KHOI was the only news outlet on hand, and we recorded the entire talk. And in fact, we will be rebroadcasting the talk on KHOI this Thursday at noon and 7 p.m. as our Heart of Iowa show. But here's an excerpt from the beginning of Eric Burmeister's talk.
In the late 90s, the state of Iowa became involved in funding affordable housing programs around the state. And they delegated that responsibility to the Iowa Finance Authority. And the Iowa Finance Authority at that time then decided that they were going to use this local housing trust fund idea as a way to distribute that state money. The state also put together, or actually IFA put together, a series of regulations that governed how local housing trust funds were to be established and how they were to be governed. Story County is one of the few counties in the state that does not have is not in some way associated with a local housing trust fund. Most of the rural counties are associated through their council of governments and are a multi-county trust fund. For the first 6 or 7 years of the State Housing Trust Fund's program's existence, it was a discretionary line item in the state budget. And so the State Housing Trust Fund allocation was not a terribly dependable source of funding. And so the program really suffered until about 6 or 7 years ago, when it was decided that there was a standing appropriation of a maximum of $6 million that would be sent to IFA under the State Housing Trust Fund program, and that IFA then was to allocate that $6 million amongst the local housing trust funds on a per capita basis, which is what happens now. It's a little more complicated than that, but suffice it to say that the state right now has about $6 million in the local housing trust fund that it can allocate amongst the local housing trust funds based upon population that they serve. I don't know what Story County's allocation would be. Find out how much state money you guys are leaving on the table, because every day that you don't access that state money, it goes pro rata to the rest of us. Now, I'm here to tell you that I like Story County's money, but I will also tell you that you are leaving state money on the table every day that you go without a local housing trust fund. Now, the state money is not free. So the fact is that a local housing trust fund must match the state dollars. It must match 25 cents of every state dollar it receives. So you have to have a local funding source that provides dollars to match the state housing trust fund money. Not dollar for dollar, but 25%. Different housing trust funds around the state have different ways of receiving that money. Some of them receive it from local government. Some of them go out in the community and raise private dollars. That's sort of your first financial hurdle, is to find out and decide where your match is going to come from.
And that was Eric Burmeister, director of the Polk County Housing Trust Fund down in Des Moines, who was here in Ames last month to tell the Ames community about this tool for funding affordable housing. And, you know, to reiterate his main point in that segment, there's a $6 million pot of state money that gets divided up among local housing trust funds in Iowa. So by not having a local housing trust fund, the Story County misses out on this money. Now, Eric Burmeister said in his talk later that their housing trust only funds permanent situations and services, but not transitional housing. He said those are just the rules that they've set up. But assuming we set up the same rules, VICMOS, can you explain how such a program that would fund the development and preservation of affordable housing in the community would impact the work that you do in the shelter?
Well, everybody that comes to our shelter has to leave at some point. All shelters that I'm aware of, all homeless shelters, are temporary. And we have to limit the stays. We have transitional housing, which gives people a more realistic chance of perhaps having 6 months or more to find housing. But at the end, there needs to be affordable housing. And that's the problem we have, is that we can do our job, but yet there's nowhere to go when people finish our program. So we really need more opportunities for people so they can have permanent affordable housing. And that's one thing that the Housing Trust Fund could work on.
Okay, and have you seen changes in the availability of affordable housing, you know, in your 30 years of service?
It has been going down every year that I've been here. I've gone back and looked at the cost of housing as a percentage of income, and that formula, it's really the key formula for understanding a lot of the homelessness, because families can only afford a certain percentage of their incomes. That has gone from 1980, I believe 1980 itself, to taking about 36% of a person if at minimum wage. Now it is in 2005 it went up to close to 60% of income just going for housing, and that's an untenable situation for families. We really need to look at how we're going to affect that formula, and making more affordable housing is certainly a key part of that.
Okay. Well, let's hear a bit more from Eric Burmeister about how a local housing trust fund operates.
So governance, the rules and regulations that govern state housing trust funds and local housing trust funds prohibit the board from being made up of more than 50% elected officials. So you must have 50% plus one local folks on the board making decisions on how to spend the money. IFA recommends that the community volunteers be made up of folks with lived experience, that is, folks who live in or need affordable housing, be made up of builders, developers, realtors, lawyers, accountants, folks that somehow bring different skill sets to the idea of affordable housing. So it is a community-based allocation. What it means is, frankly, when the rubber meets the road, is that whomever you get your match from is not going to have control over the money that they give to the local housing trust fund. Once that money is given as a match, that money is allocated by the local housing trust fund board. So, what can you allocate the money for? It's pretty broad. Our agreement with the county allows us to allocate money to projects that create and preserve affordable housing and for services that assist people that live in affordable housing. It also allows us to pay our overhead. The Polk County Housing Trust Fund does three things. We do research and planning around affordable housing. We know who in Polk County and in the region needs affordable housing. What do those households look like? Are they singles? Are they families? How many kids? We also know what the inventory of affordable housing is in Polk County. Our goal, obviously, then with our funding is to match the need with the available inventory. We also are the advocacy group for affordable housing. We know that affordable housing is not the most popular cause in central Iowa. In fact, there's always a lot of work to do when developers try and find sites for affordable housing. And so we are the organization that's responsible for making sure that the community understands the benefits of affordable housing. So education and planning, advocacy, and funding are the three things that we do. And the funding is based on a housing allocation plan that fills certain silos. New rental housing, owner-occupied repair. Also, we have an allocation for repair and maintenance of existing multifamily affordable housing. In any given year, we allocate between $2 and $2.5 million of funds for affordable housing across those things that are in our housing allocation plan. And sometimes, depending upon what we're funding, we may, in fact, get back from the developer, either in interest or return on principal, part of the money that we allocate, which is why, over time, our allocations get larger, because while we don't get 100% of the money that we allocate returned, over time, the trust fund should begin to structure its loans or its grants to be self-sustaining. Or at least certainly our goal is to have our overhead be self-sustaining.
Okay. I thought it was very interesting that Eric Burmeister spoke of advocacy and research as central roles of the Housing Trust in Polk County. So, Jan, Flora, as a founding member of the Amos Affordable Housing Group here in Ames, you have been an advocate, and you've also done research on the housing situation. Can you tell us what that's been like? What are some statistics you've shared with leaders to convince them of the need? Do you feel that they have been convinced?
Well, if we look at Ames, we have a typical problem of a college town, and it's exaggerated by the fact that we've had an increase in enrollments at Iowa State of about 40% over the past decade. So we are a community that has some people who have good incomes, and we have lots of people who don't have very good incomes because you have a lot of people working in services. One of the things that I was impressed with, not positively, when I first came to Iowa State was to find that all of the secretaries in our department lived outside of Ames because they couldn't afford to live here. And it's gotten much worse in the 20 years since then. So that's one of the issues that we have to deal with. Some of the statistics that support that is, number one, we have a vacancy rate for both owner-occupied and rental housing in Ames of around 1%, which is only about a fourth or a fifth as much as you would have just under normal circumstances of people moving in and moving out of the community.
Okay, so a 1% vacant rate would mean that if you counted all the houses and apartments, only 1% of them are available for rent at any time or for purchase.
Exactly.
And so that kind of creates a bottleneck of people needing housing.
Yeah. And another statistic that I think is kind of shocking is that the average earning for all private sector jobs in Ames is either insufficient or barely sufficient to cover the bare-bones spending for necessities of a two-child family with one wage earner. So a single mom, for instance, who has a full-time job would have difficulty surviving.
Right. The private sector being all those jobs besides the university jobs and city jobs that employ people as, you know, checkout people in the supermarket and waitresses and things like that. So the average is insufficient, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
So if we want people to be able to live where they work, or if they want to do that, then we need to figure out ways that the cost of housing can be cheapened for them.
Yeah, and that's been a central theme for the Affordable Housing Amos Group, I think, to, that people who work here should be able to live here. We are talking about the need for affordable housing in Story County with Ames City Council member Amber Corrieri and two members of a local advocacy group, Jan Flora and Vic Moss. Specifically, we've been talking about a funding tool, local housing trusts, that other counties use to create and preserve affordable housing, and a recent talk by Eric Burmeister. KHOI will be airing this talk Thursday at noon and 7 p.m. as a Heart of Iowa program, and it will be available on our website. After his initial presentation, the floor was open to question and answer. And in this section, the conversation became more wide-ranging and actually really interesting. One person asked a key question, how do you get developers interested in doing affordable housing? Here's Eric Burmeister's response.
Developers will build what is profitable and what sells or what rents. They also look very much for incentives to do it. And so to me, having the development community understand the marketplace and understand the population is important. The second thing is anything that you can do to provide them incentives to do what it is, to build what it is that you want them to build, is a plus. But for the most part, people will build what is easiest. And the fact is right now that most cities in and around central Iowa are just platting, you know, 80-foot lot after 80-foot lot after 80-foot lot. And builders are buying them because that's what's available. It becomes up to the cities and the communities to start saying, what do we want our community to look like and what is sustainable over time? And building $300,000 houses from a workforce standpoint is not sustainable over time. And sooner or later, growth and development is going to stop because there just aren't many jobs being created out there that support a $350,000 or $400,000 house. There are some, but not a lot. There are a lot more jobs being created where reasonably affordable housing is going to be necessary. Well, I tell people, I'm going to retire when the first major business comes into Central Iowa and says, we want to build a gazillion-dollar home office here, but we have a certain number of our employees that make less than $35,000 a year, and we want to know where they're going to live within 2 miles of where we're going to build. That's success in my book, because the fact is that that's what's going to create an urgency on the part of local government to take a look at their zoning ordinances, to take a look at their community character plans, to take a look at all of the things that they do either consciously or unconsciously to zone out affordable housing, because taxable assessed valuation is the pole star of what local governments want. And so when you can manage to marry the two, that is the organizations or the folks that create taxable assessed valuation and have an interest in making sure that their workforce has affordable housing, that's when you really, really start to make progress on that gap. And that's proven over and over in larger metropolitan areas where businesses do that and say, listen, our geographic footprint is so big that if you want us to build whatever it is, our home office building or our new retail center or whatever it is, then we need to make sure that there are places within a reasonable distance, some of them in urban areas, within walking distance, where our employees can afford to live. And that's when you start to really make progress.
Okay. Eric Burmeister of the Polk County Housing Trust. Responses from my guests. What were your thoughts on those, the many ideas that he presented there?
I haven't seen anybody that seems to have put the whole issue together as succinctly as he has. And so I'm very optimistic if we can start going in the directions he's talking about, we can really make some changes.
Okay. I would agree. I think that Eric's perspective definitely addresses the idea of low-income housing, but also the entire spectrum of housing and what's affordable for people at different income levels. The council hosted an entrepreneur workshop several weeks ago with representatives from Iowa State and local entrepreneurs. And rather than hear things, you know, were too difficult to start a business in Ames, the common theme that we heard was, you know, we'll figure out the financing end and the codes. Just make sure that our employees have a place to live and that they have amenities here that can support their desire to live here. And I think that was really good for the council to hear that these entrepreneurs who are starting and growing businesses in our community and want to stay here simply want their employees to be able to live and play here as well. So,
okay. And we have one more clip from Eric Burmeister's talk about housing policies.
Amy Erica Smith, so you framed this as being a situation where low-income housing in some circumstances is just not going to be profitable without some public subsidy, without some public investment. Mm-hmm. Surely there are policies mm-hmm. that can affect the profitability even absent public subsidies. What are the policy changes, particularly within this local area, that can be taken without investment of actual public money in particular units?
There are all kinds of ways that different communities have sought to build affordable housing. Smaller lot sizes. West Des Moines, for instance, has a community character plan that requires that you be able to park 2 cars undercover. That is, you've got to have a 2-car garage, and you must have enough concrete, i.e. driveway, to park 2 additional cars off the street. It's because that's a community character that they want. They don't want cars on the street. And a lot of communities have minimum square footage requirements. It says you can't build a house unless it's at least this big. There are a lot of communities that have a requirement for a certain amount of brick or stone on an exterior. We did a study on what different community character plans and zoning ordinances added to the cost of a house. And, you know, you're not talking about, you know, a couple of thousand dollars. You're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for the cost of a single family residence. The other thing is, and again, don't understand where Ames is on this, but for multifamily housing, there are limits on density per acre, number of people per acre. And obviously one of the ways to make housing affordable is to increase density. And if your community has limitations on density, that's going to drive up the cost of multifamily housing.
Okay, Eric Burmeister, community character was what he was speaking of. It's a very interesting term, and community character is something that our residents in Ames feel very passionate about. We saw how passionate folks were about the possibility of too much student activity near them in the old middle school development project by Breckenridge that got ditched. So is our community ready for a broader discussion of community character that would include looking at this need for affordable housing? I'm going to ask you, Amber, as a city council member, your perspective.
I think we're certainly ready for the conversation. We're probably past being ready for the conversation. And we have a long history in Ames, of course, of people being very involved in how our community looks and the things that we're able to offer our residents. So, but you did refer to the Breckenridge issue, and I think it will be a very deliberate conversation that we have when we start talking about some of these more creative ideas related to affordable housing and whether the community will support those ideas. I don't think we know that yet, and neighborhood involvement will be critical to that process because I do think you need to balance the ideas and desires for long-established neighborhoods with the needs to serve the rest of your community and figure out how to make those two cohesively work together.
Thank you. Okay, we've run out of time. I do want to mention the conference that Amos will be putting on March 29th sponsored by the City of Ames, by Iowa State University, possibly also by the county supervisors. We'll find out tomorrow. And it's quite a coordinated effort that you all are pursuing. And thank you, all of you, for joining us on this conversation about affordable housing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stumbling block. Stumbling block. Stumbling block. I can't get around it, and I can't get through it. I can't go over it, and I can't go under it. I'm scared of what I might find if I ever get behind it. Stumbling block. Stumbling block. Stumbling block. If I wait for a while, it just might go away. I suppose I should get down on my knees and pray. I'm sure if I got one good night's sleep, it'll look better in the day. Stumbling block, stumbling block. Stumbling block. Maybe I should pay someone to come here and remove it. Or I could just chip away at it bit by little bit. I guess I could build me a bomb and blow it up in one big hit. Stumbling block, stumbling block, stumbling block.
The This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. That was Paul Kelly and the Stormwater Boys. And we've got plenty of stormwater these days. And I'm sure our next guest, Keith Morgan of Story County, is monitoring the possibility of flooding and the kinds of emergencies that it produces. But we actually brought Keith in today to talk about preparedness measures for a different kind of disaster that has been on Americans' hearts and minds a lot lately. Whether ideologically motivated or simply the angry and disgruntled profile mass shooters continue to make the news in ever more terrifying ways, and their actions have given many of us pause to think about what we would do in such an event. So as director of Story County Emergency Management, it is Keith Morgan's job to think about what we do in such unlikely and yet possible events. And as it turns out, he and his network have been thinking about what should happen if a violent intruder was to threaten a public or private establishment in our community. It's an unsettling thought, but Keith is going to put us at ease. Right, Keith?
Well, I'm not sure if I'll put anybody at ease, but I do want the folks across the county and in the area to know that we are looking at this. And unfortunately, these are a rather high-profile events when they do occur, but they are a low occurrence. But still, it's something that all of us need to be thinking about in terms that there is something we can do about it. And that is by us as emergency management, we're reaching out to our partners. And our partners are both law enforcement, fire, EMS, and also businesses and any place where there are large gatherings to try and prepare folks for this. This is something that spans across all of the disciplines of first responders and also across all the different jurisdictions. And that's why we have some guests here with us that can speak to some of the different aspects to it.
That's great. I was just going to ask you to help us introduce them.
We have Sergeant Nick Lenny, who's from Story County Sheriff's Office, and we have Micah Anderson, who is works in the jail's office. But more importantly, they're part of our planning team. We've put together a planning team here in Story County that has involved the fire chiefs, the directors of emergency medical services, our first responders in the different communities, and also the hospitals, to start to look at this type of an event and to bring the different aspects of it together, which is law enforcement, which is the first that are going to go into the scene, but also so that our fire and our EMS, when they arrive on scene, everybody knows what everybody else is going to be doing so that we can maximize our ability to respond to one of these events.
Okay. Well, let me welcome both of you, Sergeant Nicholas Lenny. Go ahead and say hi. People can't see you nodding.
Hi.
Okay. And Assistant Jail Administrator Micah Anderson.
Good morning.
Good morning. All right. So, Keith, tell us more. The work you've been doing is called active shooter planning.
Yeah, we call it active shooter. And I'd like to first off talk or have our folks from the law enforcement side talk about some of the planning that they've already initiated, especially with our schools.
Sure. Well, one thing that I'd like to point out is Iowa generally has been a very proactive state when it comes to active shooter. We've been looking at this many years ago, and specifically Story County has been very proactive with this. Micah and myself have been through the what we call the ALICE training in July of 2011, and we had the ALICE program implemented into our office several years before that. So we've been going at this for quite a while. We've been very involved with our schools throughout the county, implementing the ALICE program starting in 2012, I believe, was our first school, Colonesco, that we went into.
Can you tell me what that means, implementing that strategy?
Sure. The ALICE program is an acronym, and it stands for Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Counter, and Evacuate. And it basically enhances what we currently had been training and teaching our kids to do, which was the lockdown or the secure-in-place type of response to an active shooter. So as opposed to telling all of our staff and our kids and the school kids to hide and lock down in one corner of the room, this provides them with more options. It gives them more information and puts more tools in their tool bag, so to speak. So it's a training that's a little more in-depth, a little more involved with the law enforcement getting into the schools and actually working with the kids.
Wow. So is there a certain age that you don't go below in terms of what you teach?
We've taught anything from pre-K all the way up through college level. Obviously, it's all age-appropriate, and the younger you go, the more age-appropriate you have to look at. But you get more into the stranger danger. But you introduce, you know, the concept of a bad guy coming into school and how they can respond to that to enhance their survivability. And that's the key to all this training, is to enhance the survivability. So it's quite a process. It's not a two-day deal where we come into a school. We will visit a school and we'll do a security assessment of the building. We'll walk around with the administration staff, and we try to highlight vulnerabilities in that structure that they may face in the event of a violent intruder. We also try to point out things that can, you know, good things about their structures that can help them. The biggest thing, budgets are tight everywhere. We try to help them implement measures that are cost effective, that don't cost a lot of money, but can make them safer at the same time. So we do that pre-assessment security check. We check into their policies. We assist them with rewriting a policy or enhancing their current policies. And then we go through with the training, the admin staff, the teaching staff, the students, all the way from K through 12. And then we follow all that up with drills.
Wow. So can you give an example of the type of thing that you would see as an asset in a school building where, this is a good, you know, a good feature that will help improve the safety of the kids?
It could be anything from the type of windows that they have installed on the building. If they're fixed windows and the windows have to physically be broken out for kids to escape out those windows, that's somewhat of a vulnerability. If it's a window that can open up easily with a handle and is wide enough for a kid to escape or a teaching staff to escape, you know, that's a plus. Another thing is movement within the structure. If you're in a room that only has one entry and one exit point in that room, that could be a vulnerability. But if you can create you know, a path where you can get from room to room to room, and a lot of schools are set up that way where you have two or three doors and they interconnect with other rooms. That's a great thing to have in your structure because it provides you the ability to move around and stay away from the shooter without getting in the line of the path of, of the shooter.
And Ames has been building a lot of elementary schools lately. Do you know if they've been thinking about this type of thing? Have you been in contact with them?
I don't know specifically. I know in this day and age, I'm quite positive they've taken that into consideration.
Just as a routine
sure.
type of measure. Okay. Micah, would you like to talk about the work that you've been doing?
Along with Sergeant Lanny and several of our other members of our office, we've been very involved with our schools. And I'll talk a little bit more about the ALICE program. Sergeant Lanny talked about it enhanced the lockdown. The old method of just sitting in one place and waiting for the police to arrive became kind of ineffective. So it's one option, but there's other options. The primary focus of the ALICE program is to evacuate, to get them out of the danger area to a safer location. That's right on the tails of the Homeland Security's Run, Hide, Fight program. It's very similar to that, a lot of the same principles. Run away if you can. If you can't run, hide in a secure location. And if, as a last resort, if somebody comes into the room where you're in, you have to fight or do some other things to secure a route of escape.
So run, hide, fight.
Run, hide, fight.
And is that something that you teach kids? You know, your first thing to do is just run, get the heck out of there. And then if there's no place to run, you hide, and then what do you tell
Absolutely.
Them about fighting?
Well, the fighting kind of raises a lot of brows. We don't actually teach, and we don't want them going out into the hallway and searching out the violent intruder and trying to take them down.
Of course not.
Obviously,
yeah.
We want everybody, staff, on down to the kids to evacuate. If you don't have any targets in the building, you know, it makes it harder. But when we get to the part about fighting, it's all about distracting the violent intruder. You can do that just by movements, throwing things at their face, yelling, screaming, noise. There's several different ways where you can counter somebody. And the word fighting is kind of misleading because it's more of a countermeasure. It's not necessarily going hands-on. There's several ways to counter and fight back without physically going hands-on with a shooter. And the whole goal of doing that is to provide the critical extra few seconds, 2 seconds, 6 seconds, 10 seconds, whatever you can distract him with, for more people to evacuate.
Okay. I always want to, when I think about this or speak publicly, emphasize that these events are rare. We certainly don't want to promote a culture of fear in our community. I looked it up, less than 1% of all murder deaths occur in mass shootings. But these same channels of communication that you are building among emergency responders and others, they are probably going to be very helpful, Keith, in the work that you do in other kinds of disaster situations. Am I right?
Exactly. I was pleased to see ALICE training implemented, because what it does, it empowers those that are in charge to take control of their situation. And it transfers that idea that somebody's going to tell me what to do, and it shows the people at the lowest level that they have a responsibility to be prepared and to bring the whole community together to be able to respond to one of these kind of events. Transfers on over to what we call all hazards, the same proactive thinking and planning and the ability to take care of yourself. Transfers over that if it's severe weather and they're away from the rest of the school administration, teachers and staff will hopefully be thinking that it is their responsibility to safeguard these students. And it transfers also to the individual to think through what they would do to be prepared should an event like severe weather or a natural gas leak nearby their house, things like that. It gets people so that they transfer from being victims to being survivors, to taking care of themselves. And this has been great to bring everybody together to think about this unfortunate issue, but it can make us much better across the spectrum.
Okay, and I have a note here that says, see something, say something. This is one of the measures that individuals can take to take care of themselves and their community. Can you describe what that message means?
Actually, I'm going to pass this on off to our law enforcement folks, because there are multiple ways, first off, that see something, say something. We have the Farm Watch and other programs, but I'd like the law enforcement to talk to that.
Well, the see something, say something concept kind of falls under the concept of it takes a community to protect a community. Obviously, there's a limited number of law enforcement personnel that patrol the county or patrol the city of Ames or campus, and so we're not everywhere all the time. So it takes everybody working together, everybody willing to be alert and paying attention to make us a safer community. So it relies on everybody to take part and everybody to take some responsibility, just to notice things that may be different. It could be a workplace situation where you have a buddy that you know is disgruntled. You know him fairly well. They've made passive comments maybe about hurting somebody, maybe shooting the place up. And that alone, you may have just blew off as him blowing off steam and not taken as a red flag. But then all of a sudden this employee gets laid off or fired, and you start noticing other red flags, drinking, gambling, just behavior, erratic behavior that isn't normal for this person. And those behaviors in and of themselves may not be red flags, but when you put all these things together, you start to draw a picture when you connect the dots that maybe there's something more going on. And it's not something a lot of times that you can say, yeah, he's going to be an active shooter or he's going to be a violent intruder, but you know that there's red flags there. That is a situation where law enforcement would like to be at least notified, you know, hey, as a heads up, or notifying your supervisors or, you know, whoever it may be in your building, just to start raising those red flags and having that line of communication. Mm-hmm. Like I said, a lot of these behaviors in and of themselves are not a red flag that the person's going to do something. But when you start putting all these things together, you know, and connect the dots, it draws a picture. And a lot of times after these events have unfolded, people who are close to the violent intruder will look back and say, we should have seen this or we should have noticed mm-hmm. this. And you get about 15 people together, and one person noticed this behavior and another person noticed a separate behavior. And you put that all together
And I imagine that it's not just a matter of being suspicious of somebody in terms of seeing something, saying something, being observant of your of the people in your surroundings. But, you know, I have been thinking a lot about that San Bernardino shooting and thinking, you know, how many people in his workplace were Facebook friends with that guy, you know, and would have seen that? How many people spoke to him at the party and just reached out in a friendly way? So I don't know. I guess I maybe that's a kind of Pollyannish view of things, but I really think that personally, we shouldn't always, the observation involves more than just suspicion. It involves reaching out in a loving way.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, within the schools, one of the things that they're working on is the bullying aspect of it. It's the preventative side of it. If you see somebody that is struggling and like that, think about different ways that you can help them through that situation. Mental illness is part of the issue also is if you see somebody that is having these kind of difficulties, see if you can't guide them towards some sort of help, mental illness, health, or just maybe all they need is just somebody to reach out to and talk to get through that difficult time. And that's, again, where we can all come together to make our communities better.
Okay, we don't have much time. Can you briefly tell us about the Farm Watch program, which is part of the See Something, Say Something?
Well, sure. The Farm Watch program, I couldn't give you the specifics. It's probably been about 3 years now where it was initiated, and it's basically an outreach program where we try to get our rural citizens in the county more involved with that See Something, Say Something type of concept. It's on the basis of communication. We want to provide an easy way of two-way communication between us and the citizens in the rural areas to get that information.
What kind of things should they be looking for?
Well, say, for instance, we have a rash of burglaries or other crimes taking place throughout the county. We may put out an alert via text message or email and provide some of that information to the rural citizens out in the county to be on the lookout for maybe a certain type of vehicle, a certain color vehicle, and they can kind of help be the eyes and ears. And vice versa, if they see something suspicious, see a vehicle parked by some tanks or taking some pictures or taking an interest in a structure, they have an easy means of contacting us and you know, saying, hey, I saw this vehicle, here's the plate. I don't know if it's anything or not, but this is what they're doing. It seemed kind of suspicious to me.
Okay. Well, thank you all for coming in and talking about this difficult issue. We really appreciate having people like you taking care of us in Story County.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. In the first half of the show, we spoke with retired ISU sociologist Jan Flora and Emergency Residence Project Director Vic Moss, both of whom are founding members of the Amos Affordable Housing Group. Joining them in that conversation about how local housing trusts and other ways communities can work toward more affordable housing was Ames City Council member Amber Corrieri. We also heard excerpts from a talk by Eric Burmeister, the director of the Polk County Housing Trust, who spoke in Ames last month. KHOI will be airing his full talk this Thursday at noon and 7 p.m. Our most recent guests here were Keith Morgan, the Emergency Management of Story County, Sergeant Nicholas Lenny of Story County Sheriff's Office, and Assistant Jail Administrator Micah Anderson. Details and links to our guests on this show will be available on our website, khoifm.org, later today, along with a downloadable version of the show. That's khoifm.org. Thanks to our webmaster, Ron Carson, for making that possible. I have been your host, Greta Anderson. Our engineer has been Nadia Abdelazim. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard Paul Kelly and the Stormwater Boys with their song, Stumbling Block. Tune in to KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for fresh local talk shows featuring people from your community. Each show airs three times, 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m., so plan to catch it at one of those times. We appreciate your listenership and your generous donations. Keep those pledges coming. We need you to help us keep this unique programming possible. Thanks again for tuning in to 89.1 FM, and we'll see you again on the radio.